morning and welcome to this month's economic update call. We provide this call as a monthly economic update for general informational purposes only. Information provided during the call is not intended to be investment advice. Opinions are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of Hancock Holding Company or its affiliates. If you have any questions that you'd like addressed on the call, please email them to david.lundgren@hancockbank.com. Today on the call, we have Chief Investment Officer John Portwood and Investment Directors David Lundgren, Jeffrey Tangus, Greg Hileski, and Luther McDougall. With that, I'll pass it on to David, who will be the moderator.
Great. Thank you, Ashley, and good morning, everyone. Welcome to another edition of our monthly update call. And, John, we'll start with you. And I guess last week we saw the first print of third quarter GDP. As many of you know, there'll be three different numbers that are released as more information is gathered. But the initial indication on third quarter GDP was that the economy grew at 1.5%, slightly less than anticipated. The consensus estimate was 1.6%. So, John, if you could give us some color around that number and also give us a little bit regarding the fourth quarter, if you could.
Okay, Dave, that 1.5% number was generally what was recorded by one of the coincident indicator sources we follow produced by the Atlanta Fed. It's called GDP Now. If anybody listening on the call wants to keep track of that on a regular basis, they update it as new data is available, and just go to the Atlanta Fed website and you can take a look at it. This is the second quarter where the continuous updating process has proved more reliable, I guess, and more accurate than the guesses produced by the consensus of economists. But in any case, it was about 1.5% on average for the entire quarter. When you break that number down, you find out that a lot of it came from healthcare and autos, and that's been sort of a theme in a lot of the quarterly GDP reports. When you look at data, see where everything came from, it's been autos to a large degree, and also healthcare spending. In terms of the leading economic indicators, as we begin the fourth quarter, they did a few weeks ago when the last numbers came out, pretty much like they did at the beginning of the third quarter. Decent, not extremely strong. You wouldn't expect that at this point in the cycle, I suppose, but not indicating a recession in the near future. About all you can expect from leading indicator estimates is that projections for the next, say, 3 to 6 months tend to be fairly accurate. So I guess we could say at this point that, we're not likely to see the typical recession within the next 6 months. And, that's good news, of course. The bad news in the GDP numbers relate to long-term trends, and long-term trends are really much more important for a determination of what's happening in the economy and what might happen to, the general level of corporate profits and standard of living than what happens from quarter to quarter. And if you look back at nominal GDP, and nominal GDP is what GDP is before you adjust for inflation, in the 20 years preceding the great crash, the number was about 5% annualized, maybe a little bit over 5% annualized, I guess, for 20 years. Since the crash, the annualized growth rate of nominal GDP has been about 3%. And, while in the short run that may not have any particular implications in a cyclical sense because it's going to bounce around to some degree, but if the trend remains at 3% for a long period of time, and it looks like, unfortunately, that since this has been going on for, 7 or 8 years, it may be a reflection of the new neutral or the new normal or the new mediocre or whatever it is, depending on whose research you read, how you want to describe this. And it does have implications long-term for corporate profits, income levels, and all sorts of things. So, if we are indeed in a new normal or a new neutral or whatever you want to call it, it's something to be aware of, as you know, we move through this period, and nobody knows how long this might last. It could last for another 10 years or another 2 or 3 years, but in any case, it looks like that trend is has now been fairly firmly established, and unless something significant happens, it could be that this is the norm for a period of time compared to what we were used to. So it's something that, of course, we have to take into consideration in terms of our, you know, investment outlooks and, you know, decisions you make relative to risk and future returns. But at least it's not negative. You know, growth of any kind is better than no growth. So, you know, in that respect, you know, it looks like we're, you know, we're moving along at a decent pace. It's just not as good as it used to be.
And, John, I guess, you know, obviously GDP is the traditional way of looking at the economy and probably the way you should look at it. But I guess another measure of an economy's health is jobs, employment numbers. Give us some analysis of what's going on from a job standpoint.
Okay. We all know that every month when the employment numbers come out, there's a lot of excitement about whether they're 150,000 or 200,000 or whatever. And there's quite a bit of noise in the monthly numbers. And the average, I believe, has been pretty close to about 200,000 new jobs being created on a regular basis for quite some time. Unfortunately, the quality of the jobs being created, particularly in the last 3 years, is not as good as everyone would like. Quite a few part-time jobs, more lower-paying jobs than higher-paying jobs. And at the same time, we're looking at a labor force participation rate that is roughly equal to what it was in the late 1970s. And another measure, similar measure, is the civilian employment to population ratio, which is significantly lower than it was in 1999. 1999 was the peak. It was about 65%. At that point, the number now is about 59.5%, which is roughly where we were back in the 1980s. So while something is happening on the positive side in terms of job growth, the total labor participation force is much lower than it used to be, and on a national level in a macro sense, you know, that's going to produce much less growth, you know, in total income than would ordinarily be the case. Something else about that that's also interesting, people have been doing some research and trying to break these employment numbers down into different categories and who's doing well from an income growth standpoint and who isn't. And one of the more interesting things that came out recently was from the Economic Cycle Research Institute. Their research shows that the least educated part of the population, of the labor force, and these would be people with a less than ninth grade education, have the highest median income increase than, let's say, the middle ranks or even those of college-educated and high school-educated people. So it's a really interesting statistic. I don't have any other details of why that might exist, but, again, it may reflect the fact that a lot of hiring has gone on in you know, lower-income areas and perhaps, you know, from an income standpoint, those people are making more money than they used to. But it's really interesting. The highest educated people, their median income is down, is down 12% in the last 15 years. It's really an interesting comparison. But anyway, it looks like the least educated, you know, have made more gains, you know, in the last 10 or 15 years than have, you know, the broader, you know, more educated middle class, which, again, you know, has an impact on growth rates, you know, and so forth. So, you know, while it looks like things are progressing and people are being hired, the, you know, the income generated, you know, by the, you know, that population is really not as high as it used to be. In fact, the wage gains are running about 2.5% on average, and that's about what it's been This is annualized. Since the crash, before that, wage gains are closer to 3%, and a lot of economists have, you know, predicted and hoped, I suppose, that, you know, wage gains would pick up, and I'm sure they are for certain segments of the population. But in the general sense, you know, wage gains, are still relatively muted, which is kind of what you would expect, I guess, since we seem to be in a, you know, relatively, you know, muted GDP growth environment compared to what, you know, we were used to, you know, 10 or 15 years ago.
John, I know a lot of, I guess, major metropolitan areas have made adjustments to their minimum wages. Could that account for that large increase?
Yeah, I would guess that's probably the case, for one reason or another, the increase in the minimum wage levels has probably had a lot, you know, something to do, certainly, with that, with that particular statistic.
Okay. And I think it was Jeff Tangus who used the analogy describing the U.S. economy as the nicest house in a bad neighborhood when describing kind of the global growth outlook. Is that still a fair analogy to describe what's going on around the rest of the globe? Are we seeing any improvement in Europe at all?
Here and there, there appears to be some bit of stability going on. And, one thing you have to be careful about when you're trying to estimate, you know, what's happening around the world or getting a good picture of what's happening to economic growth rates. Again, just like focusing on the longer-term trend in the U.S. is more important than what happens from quarter to quarter. And the same thing is true in Europe. You can have cyclical improvements, you know, in some of these countries, and you're not even coming back to the what the historic trend line used to be. So, while it looks like you're not necessarily falling off a cliff in a number of countries, the growth remains, relatively subdued, and, you know, the trend rate is just not particularly good at all. And, you know, obviously, deflation has been a big problem. A lot of these countries that were engaged in commodity production or anything involving directly or indirectly the use or the production of commodities are having a hard time because commodity index has come down substantially. In fact, the Bloomberg Commodity Index now is lower than it was in 2002, reflecting what's happened to oil prices, copper, industrial materials generally, and that's an outgrowth of a lot of stimulus around the world, a lot of QE everywhere that produced a lot of capacity that's now excess capacity, and so you've got falling prices, which are adding to the pressures overseas. At the same time, you've had a big buildup in debt, and we've talked about that before, that if debt increases faster than GDP growth, then you're likely to have some problems, and it certainly weighs on wealth creation and GDP growth generally. And the Bank for International Settlements had a report last month. They indicated that looking at the entire global economy, adding up all the government debt and the private debt, was about 265% of GDP. That's higher than it was at the peak prior to the peak of the last credit cycle. And individual studies have suggested that once you get to that level or something above 200% of GDP, it begins to have an impact on growth. And that people argue about how much of an impact it is and how much it does slow GDP growth, but it appears to have a negative impact. And if you've got an entire global situation where debt appears excessive at this time, then I guess you would expect some drag on GDP growth. But, the leading economic indicators in the U.S. are stronger than the leading economic indicators globally. If you look at the leading indicators outside the U.S., you see a declining trend relative to our leading indicators that are relatively stable. So, it looks like we've still got a relatively slow growth situation overseas. And complicating it all, of course, is that, the Eurozone hasn't solved its problems relative to Greece and a number of other countries that aren't doing that well. And at the same time, now they've got this immigrant problem, which apparently threatens to spin out of control. The Germans agreed to take 800,000 people, migrants as they're called, recently, and some people have said it might reach a million because they don't know where they all are. I guess they can't keep up with them, and obviously that's going to put a strain on their welfare system. Recently, there was an article suggesting that 80% of those people probably were unqualified, in quotation marks, you know, to accept a job should it be available without without training and so forth and so on, and that, you know, you might have you know, a significant, I've forgotten what the number was big impact on the German welfare state. Sweden, which is a small country, they only got about 10 million people. They've taken a number of immigrants over the years. They've agreed to take some, but the you know, one of the government officials in Sweden recently announced that somebody had to do something pretty fast or they would face financial collapse because they can't take care of all these people. So, you know, this adds to the problem, you know, in Europe, and is going to put some pressure on growth there, too, for a while, which means that inflation, you know, in a worldwide sense, in a global sense, or inflation even here is probably something that doesn't need to be worried about for a while, at least.
Okay. Thanks, John. Good morning, Luther.
Morning.
So you heard John's comments, mediocre economy, you know, slow to no inflation, yet it sounds like, based on a lot of Fed commentary, all of a sudden December is a possibility again for liftoff. So where are we? This is, it seems like a never-ending saga on when they're going to raise rates or not. Give us some insight, please.
Well, I think not only is the Fed confused is the wrong word, but let's say undecided, but investors are definitely confused. As you mentioned, the market is pretty much looking for or at least a 50% probability that the Fed will raise rates in December. Back in September, that was originally when people thought the Fed might raise rates, but the Fed came out and said because of the global economy and the what was happening in China, they didn't think that was the right time. Then in October, when nobody expected a rate increase, they came out and said things are looking a little bit better. This morning's headline in, from Bloomberg is that the big three are expected to reinforce December as a liftoff option. And what they're talking about are Yellen, New York Fed President Dudley, and Vice Chairman Stanley Fisher have been the outspoken members of the FOMC talking about increasing interest rates. And what they're looking at is a lot of economic data. As John mentioned, it's kind of a mixed bag with nothing really overly positive. You know, we have jobs that are kind of weak. Manufacturing, retail spending, and exports have also been a disappointment. But over the last couple of months, we've seen that jobless claims continue to go down. Now, the quality of the jobless the jobs numbers is in question, as John mentioned, and housing has actually picked up a little bit. So the Fed is in a between a rock and a hard place in that they've been talking about raising rates for some time now, but for whatever reason of the month, they've not done anything. I think we'll get a very good picture today because the three members of the FOMC that I just mentioned all will have speaking engagements today and may give us a better indication of what's going to happen with the Fed funds rate. You know, it jumped up, or the possibility jumped up back on October 28th after the last meeting from 33% to 50% for a Fed increase. And I think to a certain extent the Fed is in a corner in a box, and they're trying to get out, and all of the data kind of points to there's no way out, but they may raise rates anyway just to have a little bit of gunpowder in reserve, you know, in case the economy slows a little further. So the Fed is definitely talking about raising rates in December, but the market doesn't believe it, which is why we're still at a 50% probability of a Fed increase on December the 16th. There is no meeting this month.
Well, I guess by the end of the day, we'll hopefully have a little bit better picture. Maybe not. I guess we'll have to wait and see. Should be in.
Oh, Dave, I just thought I'd just for the sake of interest, I guess, it's certainly probably not imminent, but hardly a day goes by now without somebody somewhere, either a research paper or a commentary or something, to the effect that since QE has been relatively unsuccessful in generating growth here, and certainly this particular subject is also talked about in international circles, that it's coming toward a time where the equivalent of a helicopter drop of money might be necessary to stimulate growth domestically and globally. And, you know, whether or not anything like this will ever happen or not is just a subject of conjecture at this point. But it's mentioned continually, almost as if, there are a large group of observers out there who are pressuring the central banks to do something, almost anything, to avoid what everybody would describe, I guess, as secular stagnation as compared to what we were, you know, used to seeing before. So it'll be interesting to see how this develops. But, I mean, the call for something more experimental than QE is becoming, a regular event. So it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out. You know, hopefully we don't go there and don't need to go there, but, we shall see, I suppose.
All right. Thank you, John. Jeff, I guess also during the month, a lot of headlines and there was some concern that we would yet again have a government shutdown. We had a change in House leadership. So political season is coming in full swing as we, are gearing up for the elections next year. Give us some commentary on, the happenings in October and how it might affect the markets going forward.
Yeah, glad to, Dave. Well, as everyone knows, we're in political season now, and October was a particularly eventful month, starting out with the fact that John Boehner, Speaker of the House, announced that he would step down from his speakership, and in doing so, he really was agreeing to take a bullet for the establishment, I'll call it, in that he would basically sacrifice in an outgoing action. He would sacrifice sort of his reputation by going back on a lot of pledges that he made and essentially pushing through a debt ceiling increase and budget increase that would have been very unpopular. The House Freedom Caucus is a group of a very conservative Republicans who had been making a lot of trouble for him, and so he decided that he had to step down. But in doing so, he pushed through a debt ceiling increase, which would have been a contentious thing all the way around now with the Republicans essentially controlling the House and the Senate. Just a long story short there, the debt ceiling increase, which actually today was the deadline, the debt ceiling increase basically suspended the debt ceiling. It didn't increase it, but it basically just suspended it until March of 2017. So unlike most times in the past where the debt ceiling is actually increased, this time they said, well, we're not going to set a debt ceiling. We're just going to set a date certain, which is mid-March of 2017, that we can operate under this suspended debt ceiling. Now, that scared some people because it sounds like it's a blank check. It's not really a blank check for the administration, but some people have made it out to be that. The bottom line was they wrote into the bill about $80 billion of new additional spending. The bottom line is Democrats and Republicans alike both want to spend money, taxpayer money. They just want to spend it on different things. Democrats want to spend it on domestic programs. Republicans typically want to spend it on defense, more defense-related items. But they all want to spend money because that's how they stay in office. So they all got together and realized that the sequester, which was passed a couple of years ago, was restraining government spending and actually creating some surpluses along the way. It was, in my opinion, a good thing. But politicians don't like to be limited in spending, so Democrats and Republicans alike agreed that they needed to increase the spending to their respective pet programs and came together. What was, I guess, sort of unseemly about this is that John Boehner actually passed this through the House with the help of Nancy Pelosi, and then Mitch McConnell got it through the Senate with the House with the help of Harry Reid. They basically brought all the Democrats and some of the Republicans enough to get this passed through. So unlike most things where it's a bill that is supported primarily by the majority, in this case the minority plus a small portion of the majority served to pass this debt ceiling through. So it just it smelled a lot for a lot of different reasons, and John Boehner, with this action basically steps aside and allowed the House to find the next House Speaker, which after a couple iterations finally settled on Paul Ryan as the 54th. So Paul Ryan comes with lots of good and bad attributes, and it remains to be seen exactly where he will fall out in terms of establishment Republican versus some of the newer Freedom Caucus conservative Republicans. But it does appear, at least by his initial actions, that he is going to be much more open and much more, I guess, using the word democratic in terms of how he pushes legislation through. It won't be just the more or less the backroom deals and the iron-fisted approach that John Boehner took, but a little bit more open to the rest of the majority. So a lot going on. Certainly there'll be a lot more as we move through time here through the election season, but October was an unusually active month on the political front, Dave.
Okay. Thank you, Jeff. Let's shift gears to stocks quickly, and good news on the stock front. Really an amazing month. Coming into October, we had the first market correction of 10% or more since 2011. And then in October, we just had an amazing month, nice little rebound. Again, the 2011, there's a lot of parallels to this year. It was the biggest one-month gain for the S&P 500 since October of 2011. The S&P 500 was up 8.4%. Small cap stocks is represented by the Russell 2000, up a little bit less at 5.6. And then international stocks represented by the ACWI ex-US, up a very healthy 7.4%. The S&P 500 has now moved in positive territory for the year. Through October 31st, it was up 2.7%. Small cap stocks and international stocks both slightly negative still for the year, but closing that gap yesterday and into today. Luther, if you could quickly drill into the numbers a little bit, and then we'll turn it over to Greg for some color regarding the month.
All right. You hit the highlights already. It was the best month since October of 2011 when the market was up almost 11%. Last month, as you noted, the market was up 8.5%. Every sector in the S&P 500 had a positive return for the month of October. The worst return was in utilities, which were up 1%. Consumer staples was second worst, up 5.8%, followed by financials, up 6%. So even though they were the worst, it's still a reasonable return for each of those sectors during the month. The best sector for the month was materials, up 13.5%, followed by energy, up 11.5%, and technology, up 10.8%. And even though materials and energy were up very much for the month, year-to-date they're still leading the downturn. Energy stocks are down 12.25% for the year-to-date, materials down 5%, and utilities down about the same. The best-performing sector was consumer discretionary, up 13.5% for the year-to-date, followed by technology, up 7.5%, and healthcare, up 5.5%. What we've seen so far this year is a big dichotomy between value versus growth stocks. Through October 31, value stocks were still negative at minus 2.09, and growth stocks are up almost 7%. So good month overall, but definitely spread around a little bit.
Okay, great. Greg, what was the catalyst? It seemed pretty dire at our last call. You know, we went through a very rough patch in the third quarter, and then everything's rosy again. What was the catalyst to make that happen?
Yeah, you know, we had a little 2 and 3% correction, but they snapped back right away, and I think we finally had that plus 10%. And I think, you know, one, the Fed remaining on hold, keeping interest rates low, pushing that deadline out is, you know, a liquidity party. So I think the market likes that. And, you know, there's some debate on whether or not they're taking into account or factoring in China's slowing economy. But, you know, I think the Fed is still focused domestically on, you know, full employment and inflation domestically. And, you know, China's a consideration, but I don't think that's going to prevent them. But overall, I think because they already put, you know, these interest rate liftoff or increases on hold, again, the market looks at very favorably. The other thing is I think just the severity of the sell-off was just insane. I mean, they were selling everything. They were just dumping stocks wholesale. Typically, when you have that kind of sell-off, really sharp, with no regard to any of the solid fundamental outlooks on most companies, you have a pretty sharp snap back, and we've seen that. We're right back really where we were when the sell-off started back in August. I think also, you know, China was a concern, but it wasn't really new news. It was old news. And I think, you know, the market and investors realized that perhaps, you know, maybe things aren't as bad as it was pictured. And I think right now the market needs some convincing that things aren't going to deteriorate further in China. So I think that could still be an element of volatility that's going to pervade the equity markets. And then Europe and Japan are still collectively more important to the global economy than China. And so they're still, you know, although weak relative to some other countries, I think that, you know, that's also a positive. Unfortunately, emerging markets are still a risk, I think, going forward. Just looking at what's to come or what's the outlook, I think that's going to put pressure on global GDP going forward. And my biggest concern, I think, with the rest of the year right now is probably the U.S. earnings outlook. We've seen reductions in earnings estimates from analysts, and so I think, that's a concern. Now, is this rally sustainable? I think it's possible. I think if we have a good retail, good Christmas season, I think that would help support the market going forward. And, you know, we could end up with a positive year. You know, we talked about it several times before with the current PE. Looking at it historically, it implies kind of a single-digit equity return this year, and I think maybe, you know, history is going to prove itself correct here. Because right now it doesn't look like economic growth is going to take off, particularly in light of the third quarter GDP print. So, it could be a positive year, but I don't think it's going to be a bang-up double-digit year going forward for the rest of 2015. So right now, kind of looking towards 2016, you know, hoping that the economy reaccelerates its growth, and then, maybe we're back on track, although, again, not a whole lot of catalysts for really, really strong growth.
All right. Thank you, everyone, for joining today. Join us next month. Our call will be on Tuesday, December 1st. Thank you for joining.